aim to play, and it's going to be a riot. Especially if you're here as a Northern student, I've got some built-in bonus points for you to get a better grade in the class, right? So anyway, why don't you guys stand up with me for a second here? This is the first one. If you know this, you're guaranteed a D. Okay, if you know this. All right. It goes like this. See if you can do it with me. Here's the church, and here's the steeple. Open the doors, and you'll see all the people. Right? Everybody know that? Okay, you can sit back down. So they all have at least a D. Fitch, at least a D. There's some more. I got a little bit of time to go here. So now that's a children's example, right? People have learned that long ago, but it's a pretty good description of the way that most people think about church, right? And you and I, we think about church more like that than we actually know that we do. It is so ingrained into who we are. And the thing about it, though, is that it is being shown, that model of church, that way of looking at church, is being shown to be less and less effective all the time. And now, there are still lots of people who go out and plant churches that do just that very same thing. And those are proving to be less and less effective all the time. I remember a couple of years ago, I was sitting with Alan Hirsch right as soon as him and Deb had come over here from Australia, and he showed me this little diagram that was really helpful to me. Maybe it'll be really helpful to you. As to trying to explain why we need to have different expressions or forms of church. And he said, you know, we come from Australia, and we're a semi-socialist country just like Canada, that we have good data on these things. And he said, so one of the things that we know in Australia is that this sort of standard model of church works for about 25% of the population. Now, that doesn't mean that they go, but it means that they would think about going. He said, but what that means is that 75% of people have already pre-decided that this is never going to work for them. And that doesn't matter if this is contemporary or traditional or super progressive or if it has the coolest band or the best speaker or the greatest light. It doesn't matter. All this, it's all the same. It's all the same expression of church. It just looks a little different on the surface. He said, we know this works for about 25% of people. He then went on to say, and I think this is probably fairly accurate, that in the United States, we could say that this works for maybe about 40% of people. Again, not that everybody goes, but that people, at least they're open to this expression of church, right? But what do we do about the growing majority? What do we do about the growing majority? And that is where this concept that is, a lot of people talk about these days of a missional church comes into play. I remember when I moved here to Richmond a couple of years ago, just to illustrate this, you probably know this in your city, I asked some pastors who had been around here a really long time, and when was they estimated the height of church attendance? Now, Jim, you may know some of this. And most people said it was the early 80s, the height of church attendance in Richmond, when we remember when the most people went to church. And I said, okay, just give me a ballpark figure. What do you think? What percentage of people? 75 to 80% is what most people. They were members. They came regularly. Now, okay, I mean, we're talking like 27, 8 years later. At best case scenario, it's in the low 30s. And you're talking not a really big gap of time here. I bet it's probably similar in your area. So when we're talking about a missional church, okay, there are two things that when I distill this down to think about it very practically, building off the church steeple illustration that we need to think about, is we need to think about unlocking the church from the church. Unlocking the church from the church so that the mental conception of what the church is for people that are in church, okay? So that we can actually unlock the church from the church, from the people of the church, from thinking about themselves at a time and a place and a location only. So that's what, to me, very simply, the word missional is about. But While I like a good theological conversation, and there are lots of good theological conversations happening out there about missional, it's confusing sometimes because now that it's so popular, everyone uses the word to mean everything, right? Okay, so I want to play a little game with you guys. You're going to need at least a team of three, all right? And you need somebody in your team to keep score. So get in a team of three. We're going to play a little game here called Is It Missional? Is it missional? Okay. You've got 3 seconds in each scenario that I give you to decide, is it missional? Okay. And you shout it out when I say, you know, is it missional? 3 seconds. You tell me if you think it's missional. Okay. I'm going to start really easy. All right. I will say some of the names of these examples have been changed to protect the innocent. Some of the specific stories have been changed to protect the innocent, but you may get a sense of some of them. All right, this one's easy, okay? First Baptist Church has been around for 150 years. They are a stable congregation of 500 people, but have been in decline since their heyday of the mid-80s when they had nearly 2,000. They haven't really added any new members other than children coming to faith and joining the church in several years. They do have a several million-dollar budget and give a great deal to missions. Is it missional? No. Oh, great. Good, good, good. All right. This one's a little harder. You get one point. Yeah. Some of these are not so easy. I'm not giving you the answer. You just keep score yourself. So you say, I'll tell you at the end. Is it missional? So you go yes or no. Okay. Regular community church is located in a growing and affluent suburb. They have 3 services on Sunday and 1 on Saturday night. They have wonderful programs for children and families, and their church is growing at 20% a year. However, only about 25% of their growth is from new converts. The rest is all transfer growth from other churches. They have started 5 other churches, though, in the last 10 years, and many of them reach new people who were previously de-churched or unchurched. Is regular community church missional? Ooh, a little harder. A little harder. Okay. You confer with your team. Come up with your answer. All right, here's another one. Incarnational Church is 2 years old. They are a small community that serves a great deal in the city. They are involved in after-school programs, mentoring children. They clean up parks. They serve a great deal. As a matter of fact, they even received an award from the mayor's office last year for all they've done in the community. But in the 2 years they have been doing this, nobody has come to Christ, though they do believe they are being a good witness to the neighborhood around them. Is Incarnational Church a missional church? Okay, here's another one. Abiding on the Branch Church is a several-year-old church that has taken up residence in a particular neighborhood. They have a strong emphasis on discipleship and community. They meet regularly for an updated form of liturgical worship and encourage a communal rhythm of life. They did start their church by sending out a postcard to the area. They have seen some strong conversions, about 10%, but they also have a number of church transfers. They are currently in the process of planting another church. Is Abiding in the Branch a missional church? Thank you. Okay, keep going. City Church is a year old. And city. Yeah. City Church, C-I-T-Y, is a year old, and they have grown to a community of 150 people through lots of public promotion, like advertising and giving out water bottles at a local shopping area. They also started an annual Christmas tree lighting in the community, and most recently they hosted a kids' festival in the city that over 450 people from the community came to. Many people they have interacted with through these outreach events have come to church. Is City Church missional? All right, let me just get a quick poll of hands on that one. Who says yes? Who says yes? That the one I just gave, City Church. Yes? Okay. Who says no? No? Okay. Let me keep going. Of these 150 people, they have baptized about 20. All of these are new converts. Well, and they are reaching a large percentage of disenfranchised church people. In addition, they regularly serve in the community, and when a local high school student was shot and killed, they were involved in the grieving of students and faculty in the school. Also, the big community picnic they threw was originally to invite their friends to and publicize the church. However, afterwards, several community leaders came to them and asked if they could partner with the church to host a series of other events because it's the only time they've actually seen Anglo and African American people in the neighborhood together. Is it missional? Okay. All right, here's another one. Horseback Community Church. is a large mega church in an affluent suburban area. They are one of the largest churches in America and lead about 1,000 people to Christ every year. They lose about 75% of these people. However, they support missions in several countries, and about 20% of their regular attenders serve abroad during the year. Is Horseback missional? Okay. I got three more. Okay. Your church is a newly developing missional community. They started with a handful of people last year, and because they were so small, they were forced to focus on solely reaching out to lost people. They serve regularly in a particular neighborhood, throwing cookouts and block parties. They've hosted a Christmas service in a garage. All in all, about 50 people are involved in your church, and at least half of them are not committed followers of Jesus. However, their focus as a church is fairly limited to these activities. They are not actively involved in any of the real needs of the city nearby or anything that would normally be considered works of justice. Is your church missional? That's good. That's just not what you think. Okay, two more, right? The Always Green Community. is 5 years old. The Always Green. They meet in pubs in a hip and trendy U.S. city. They have several different gatherings and their worship is very experiential. They reach lots of people who find Always Green before they've given up our church or left church. They regularly serve at the soup kitchen and contribute in other ways to the betterment of the city they live in. Is Always Green missional? One more. Okay. The totally new community, totally new, is 3 years old. They have experienced steady and consistent growth from an initial core of 50 people. They now have over 200 in attendance. They host skeppies in a local bar, and they even started a farmer's market in their town. Every Easter, they throw a huge outdoor Easter service in the city park that is very attractional and draws several hundred people. It's totally new missional. Okay. There is more. They only meet as a whole church every other week. The other week, they meet as house churches. They have also adopted several people with special needs in their community and are regularly involved in the life of the town. They have been in the paper several times. Is it missional? They're very popular. Okay, hopefully you got from that the genuine difficulty of deciding whether something is missional or not. Some are easy, some is very hard. I find it to be actually, when you try to press it down, a very difficult thing to decide what is and what isn't. So I prefer, when talking about church planning, a less ethereal term, a missionary church. It's more clear to me, at least to me. And here's how I would think about it, right? I do want to say, like Bob said, that there are several things in this that are certainly not for me. I owe a great deal to some people named Bob and Mary Hopkins from England, and Mike Breen, a little bit to Neil Cole, and a guy named George Patterson. You know George Patterson? You don't know that name? Oh, we have to talk about that. For talking about a lot of this. But a missionary church, this is a little, it's very simple, right? But mission, God's mission, right, is all that God intends for His creation, right? Evangelism, at least for me, as I think about the church planning, is at the heart of mission. Now, most missional churches, right, they tend to focus on these sorts of things, right? Justice, serving in the city, mentoring kids, all great things, right? It's all in the environment, all part of what God intends for His creation. This tends to be more on the back burner. Now, evangelistic churches, you could call them by various names, they focus a lot on this and don't do as much of this, right? Okay, I think a missionary church, when we're thinking about our strategy for church planting, which we start to get into tonight, is a church that either does this so that it can do this, or it does this so it can do this. It has to do both of these things. But if it only does this and it never gets here, it's not really a missionary church. Okay? So a missionary church is a church that as a whole operates itself as if it was a missionary team or community sent to a foreign land, even though the land is local. Because a vast majority of those involved see themselves as a missionary or apostle to their city, their community, their work, and their neighborhood. Okay? In other words, you have a missionary church when you have missionary people. And it is your job as pastors and church planters to help cultivate a missionary people who focus on both parts of that circle. So what I'd like to do is I want to walk through what I believe was Paul's missionary strategy. Paul's missionary strategy, which I think he got from Jesus, and we'll see that in a little bit, about how he went about doing his work. And I think it provides, hopefully, some a basic framework for how we're going to move forward for this week. So in your notes, this is a little bit confusing because in the last several days, I was able to come up with a diagram that, at least for me, helped picture this easier. But we know, right, if you're a good missional person, you know that mission begins with the God who sends, right? So God calls you, calls people in your team to plant a new community, right? So it's the God who sends, what God did with Paul, right? We know Acts 13, they're in Antioch, they're praying. The Holy Spirit says for me, set apart who? Barnabas, and they pray over them, and off they go. Right, there's various times in which God intervenes in Paul's travels, telling him to go to a new direction, sending him to a new place. One time he shows up in a vision and says, I want you to head to Macedonia, right? So he is continually involved in Paul's work. Now, when you get to Acts chapter 17, okay, a couple of those things have happened. And he arrives there. And if you have a copy of the scriptures, which I thought that I did. There we go. Turn to Acts chapter 17. And I just want to walk through this a little bit. I want to say at the outset that there's people I know who don't tend to think that this is a good paradigm for Paul's work. Because they would say he did something different in Athens than he did in any other place. And you look at his effectiveness, and it was a lot less effective because he tried to talk to the people in power and engage the people in the city and preach this like culturally relevant sermon. And my take on that is that Paul always did the same thing. He didn't deviate in this place. But Athens was the most difficult place he ever went. Okay, it was the most wealthy, the most powerful, it was the most intelligent city he ever went. And he walked out of there with a decent number of people who came to Christ or wanted to find more about the way. So I think that's pretty good, you know, if you were to put that in our standards today. So I think Paul did the same thing he did everywhere, and we're going to walk through and look at that. So Acts chapter 17, I'm going to give you a little backstory here, something that I think helps alive in this passage when we read it. And it's from about 500 years before Paul's story here in Acts 17. In the 6th century B.C., there was a man named Nicias who stood before the Athenian council on Mars Hill, and he reported back from a trip that he had just taken to the Pythian Oracle. Okay, this was a desperate trip because Athens had been plagued with the disease for some time. Nicias reported to the sitting council. He said, "Our city is under a curse. The priest at the oracle revealed that a certain god is punishing us for the heinous crimes of our former king." A council member spoke up and said, "What god could this be? We've offered sacrifices to every god. I can't imagine what other god there could be." Nicias replied, "I don't know either, nor did the priest at the oracle. But," he said, "we must send a ship to Crete to fetch a man named Epimenides. The oracle assured me that he will know how to appease this god." So after much debate, the humbled council agreed to seek the help of this foreigner. Very soon, Epimenides stepped off the ship in the harbor town of Piraeus and his traveling party, and they began to walk up the road to Athens. As they walked up, signs of the plague surrounded them everywhere. Rather than being surprised or shocked by the epidemic, Epimenides was surprised by something else. He remarked to the boys who were guiding him to the Mars Hill, he said, "Never before have I seen so many gods. In fact, it is probably easier to find a god here than a man." At that, Nicias laughed. He said, "Yes, but for the life of us, we can't figure out what god this could be. We worship every possible god we could imagine." The next morning, Epimenides stood before the council on Mars Hill, along with a flock of choice hungry sheep that he had requested the night before. As the foreigner stood there in front of the council, hundreds and hundreds of Athenians gathered there looking for a sign of hope. Epimenides addressed the council. "I'm going to offer a sacrifice based on three assumptions. The first one is that there is a god out there somewhere, and we don't know what his name is, but somehow he's connected to our plague. The second assumption is this, is that if we invoke the help of this god, that he is great enough and good enough that he will come to our aid." At that, one of the young men in the crowd yelled out, "How can we call upon the name of a god when we don't know what his name is?" Epimenides replied, "That's my third assumption, that this God is so great and so good and so gracious that if we call upon his name, he will smile on our ignorance, as long as we acknowledge that ignorance before him." And so they all looked at the sky, and Epimenides cried out, "Unknown God, Agnos Theou, look down upon this city, forgive this city, deliver this city. And now if you would choose the sheep that you desire, if you would cause them to lie down upon the grass, we'll sacrifice them to you." With that, they released the hungry sheep to wander around the grassy hill. Several of the sheep miraculously began to lie down rather than graze with the rest of the flock. Artisans immediately began to mark the spot, collect the sheep for a sacrifice. Epimenides instructed them to build an altar on the spot, a statue, and to inscribe it to the Agnos Theou, the unknown God. They did as he instructed and sacrificed the sheep. That very day, the plague began to lift, and within a week, the people of Athens were well again. Well, half a century later, There's another foreigner, this time a Jew, gets off a ship in the harbor town of Piraeus and walks up the same long road to Athens that Epimenides did 500 years before. And his story begins like this. While Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing a city full of idols. Okay, so I want to walk through this. And again, this is Paul's missionary strategy. First thing that he did, he walked, observed, and he saw that the city was full of idols. If you skip ahead to verse 22 and 23, he gives a little commentary on that. He says, "For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, right, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Now, what you worship is something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you." See, Paul starts his missionary enterprise here in Athens with what he saw. Okay? With what he saw. He walked around and he looked carefully at what was there. So, the first thing to keep in mind in your church planning efforts is that you have a missionary sphere. You have one as a church. You have one as an individual. Your people in your church plan have a missionary sphere. Paul walks around, he looks, and you can just imagine, you know, he saw all these architectural marvels, all these wonderful things that had been built in Greece, and he also saw the idols. Okay? He saw what was right there in front of him. Now, when we have our missionary spheres, okay, there are really just two options that are available to us, right? You can have a neighborhood, or you can have a network. Okay, so in your missionary sphere, you need to do some walking and some seeing. And what you're looking for is you're looking for in the neighborhood or network that you want to plant a church among. Okay? Neighborhood's easy enough. Everyone understands what that is. Network could be, I want to plant a church among the creative class. I want to plant a church among runners. I want to plant a church among, people who are involved in justice work for nonprofits in the city. Okay, that's a network. Young families. Now, when you start to get into your target area, your missionary sphere, it's really important that you don't start too broad. Greatest church planting error is to start too broad. People come in and they say, "I love this city. I want to be about this whole city. We're going to reach the whole city." And that is probably not going to happen because that's not your job to reach the whole city. So you need to narrow down a focus area so that you can actually focus. A neighborhood or a network. Now within that, every member of your church has a missionary sphere. And the missionary sphere that they have, that you have as an individual, is what you see right in front of you. So, that could be a person is at their job. Okay, they have a missionary sphere at their job. It's what they see right in front of them. It's not hard. Could be they go to the gym. That's their missionary sphere. It's what they see right in front of them. To have a missionary church full of missionaries, you need to help people identify their missionary sphere. And to understand their sphere, they have to do some seeing and some walking. Some seeing and some walking. And you've got to ask yourself some questions about what you see. And when you walk, for instance, you see things differently than when you drive. You see specific houses. You see what they're like. How they are treated. You hear people talking, okay, as they come in and outside of their house. You hear people talking when you're sitting in the coffee shop. Okay, some of the greatest insights I've learned about Richmond was by accidentally eavesdropping on conversations other people were having while I was sitting in Starbucks. I, for instance, learned that within a half a mile radius, there were two Starbucks, and one of them, 75% of the customers were men, and the other one, 75% of the customers were women. Now, why do you think that is? Business district. Yeah. Okay. So, where did I choose to hang out? The one with the men, right? The one with the most of the men. That's where we chose to go. Yeah, and that's not a trick question. So, you learn by walking, seeing, and listening. Help people think, okay, in their office or in their in their gym. Okay, where do people gather in their office? Where are their water coolers, so to speak? Are people finding meaning in their work? Do they talk to other people that they work with? You know, how many people that you pastor or shepherd, you know, they go to work, they sit in their cube, and they leave. That's what they do. They've got to approach their space, their sphere, what they see in front of them, like a missionary. If your sphere is larger, like the area you're planting a church in, you might need to do some driving through the area. See what you see when you're driving. Pay attention to school district lines and boundaries. They tell you different things about the area. And J.R. Briggs will get into that on Wednesday. While you're doing this, you also need to do some feeling. Okay? Verse 16, Paul says that he was greatly, it says about Paul, he was greatly distressed. Okay? It's from a Greek word, paroxysm or paroxmo, which means a deep distress that is a feeling of anger and sorrow mixed together. Okay, this is what Paul's response was to what he saw in front of him. Now, as you are getting into your missionary sphere, okay, there's going to be different things that bubble up in your heart that you feel. Okay? And those things should be some clues that God is giving you as to how you are uniquely shaped and what your church and you should be passionate about and might want to respond to. Where do you feel a sense of God's calling in relationship to what you see? A good question to ask your team in response to what they're seeing and what they're feeling is, where do you think God might be at work between those two things? And if you're going to do this, like Paul, we need God's eyes to see what's right in front of us, to see things as God sees them. And that comes about through revelation. Revelation. Now, there's lots of different ways that revelation comes. I'll tell you that, church planning will mess with your theology. It has for me. Okay, if you get in there and you're really planning a missionary church where things that you are expecting, that you're not expecting to happen are happening, which they will, it will mess with your theology. So I'll just say, for example, for me, you know, I came to Richmond not a charismatic. Okay? I am now a charismatic. I'm a charismatic in the sense of believing in all of the gifts of the Spirit being accessible to people, believing that God does intervene and act powerfully in ways today as He did long ago, and I did not believe in those things before. I was not trained to believe in those things. I was trained to dismiss those things. I could give you every theological reason why they had disappeared. But getting involved in the actual difficulty of church planting and seeing God come through in ways that I couldn't explain or expect, including my own health, it changed. It changed what I thought. We now regularly have people in our church who receive dreams. And those dreams, while they don't necessarily make sense right away, they have come to fruition 6 months, a year down the road in people's lives. I'll give you an example. And it's because my theology changed. So I started talking about this stuff and trying to figure out, God's revelatory power. Okay, obviously supported by Scripture. But a year ago, a girl came to me and said that she had a dream about these two other girls in our church that were sitting at a table. And one of them had come to our church 1 week. So she had met her. She had this dream about this girl. And in that, they were talking about something from Luke chapter 14. This was a dream. And this one particular girl, we'll just call her Kelly, was talking about some difficult decisions that she had to make in her life in relationship to this passage. So this other girl came to me. She said, I had this dream. I don't really know what to do about it. And I just said, why don't you just write it down? Hold on to it. It might be important sometime for Kelly. So a year goes by. Kelly is, was a nominal Christian. She's now growing in her faith, but she's still dating a loser who is dragging her down. And she is on the verge of breaking up with this guy, but just can't get to the place where she can actually do it. So she's sitting at a table one day telling this to this other girl, who had just come one time, has now been around a year. And explaining this to them, and it dawns on this girl, I had a dream about this a year ago. And she was able to take her to the page that she had dated in her journal. Here's what I dreamed. I think that this might be the situation that God was asking you to do something difficult, and he told you he would be there for you. This kind of stuff is happening semi-regularly in our church community now because God messed with my theology. And I want to say that because in church planting, okay, a friend of mine, he's a missionary in Toronto right now, and he had to go through some intense training leading up to him leaving. And just before I asked him, I said, you know, what are you going to do when you get to Toronto? He told me that what they were going to do is for a year, they were going to prayer walk the city. And I said, well, you know, why are you going to do that? And he said that they were going to do that because the most massive study on mission strategy ever had just been completed. And that they had surveyed what God had been doing a long time among thousands of people groups in all sorts of countries, rich, poor, Asian, Anglo, African, Middle Eastern, young, old, those who had a written language, those who didn't, over the course of decades. And here's what they found. There were certain strategies and ways of engaging a mission that worked for particular people groups better than others. But there was one thing across the board in all circumstances that worked, where they compared when they did this versus when they didn't do this, and the difference was remarkable. And that one thing was walking and praying for your area. He told me that in this study, where there was prayer walking, there was a far greater number of people who had been healed of physical ailments. A far greater number of people who had been relieved from oppression and burdens, and a far greater number of people who had come to trust Christ. Now, this study was conducted by a fairly conservative denominational mission agency who typically doesn't promote these sorts of things in the United States. God's revelatory power, he said, worked through them to reveal things to them, to show things to them, to direct them through the engagement with walking and praying for their city. So, be sure that you walk and pray for your neighborhood. It is, at least according to this mission agency, the number one thing that you can do. Number one thing. Walking, praying, talking, seeing. Missionary engagement broadens through, okay, so you start doing these things, right? It broadens through places of openness. I don't even know if I spelled that right. Places of openness. This is very important, okay? Paul goes, it says, so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked him, what is this babbler trying to say? Others said he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting in the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange things to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. Because all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. So, two critical things about Paul's missionary approach here. First, Paul goes into the city of Athens seeking open doors. Another way you could say it is fertile soil. His first step in seeking fertile soil is that he goes to the synagogue. Now, this was almost always Paul's predominant first step in his missionary strategy because he went into an area looking for the God-fearers. The synagogue was a place where the barriers were lower. Barriers were lower. They had knowledge about the story that Paul was giving an answer to its completion. Okay? This is a place where there was receptivity. Now you go to, let's say, Philippi, right? There's no synagogue in Philippi, so what does Paul do? He goes to a place of prayer. And he finds a number of women who are down there by the river, praying. Okay, he always starts with places of openness where the barriers are lower. And his communication there always responded with where he was and who he was talking to. Okay, in other words, this is what I think that you need to take from that. Okay, you will build and develop your church community from among people where God is already at work and where there are lower barriers. Okay. Lots of people come into an area and they think we're just going to reach totally radically people that are like so far from Jesus. And unless you are gifted as like one of the best evangelists around. That is probably not going to happen. Okay, there's a few people out there who are gifted like that, but most people are not. Your community is going to initially be birthed from people who you can connect with, who are open to you, talk about it in a minute, open to perhaps the gospel, who maybe have some church background, experience, some disciples from another church. And what you're going to need to do is then equip them and together build bridges to the other groups of people. It is going to be very hard to step from you to people who are very far from Jesus. You're going to need people in between. Even a church that I mentioned in our thing, it's called Our Church, so I said Your Church, pastored by a guy here in Richmond, about 20 minutes from here, who's the best evangelist I've ever met. His name is Matt Singer. Started 18 months ago. They now have about 60 or 70 people. 80% of their church community, right, were either people that are not Christians currently or were not when they started. And it's one of the best, most incarnational evangelistic churches I've ever seen. But even them, they still had a team of 6 to 10 people from the beginning who they equipped to then help them reach out to these other groups of people who were further from them. They had been doing the same work for 5 years by themselves without a lot of effectiveness. They added some people around them, actually birthing a church community, and they started to see some fruitfulness. So a question you'd ask yourselves is, what are the synagogues or places of fertile soil that you know about in your town? Could be some normal examples, right? People who used to go to church but haven't been in a long time. Christians that have just moved to an area that are interested in finding a new expression of church. New people that just moved to an area. New parents who all of a sudden are feeling the need to get their life in order. Single people that are going through a breakup or job or career crisis. Okay? Think about your area. Okay, where are the places of fertile soil? Could be from a parent church where people who are just longing to do something more substantial with their faith. Where are the places of fertile soil? But Paul doesn't stay there, right? So he goes to the synagogue, but he also goes to the marketplace. The marketplace is where the soil is not as fertile. This is where people have less knowledge. They do not have a predisposition to what Paul's proclamations are about. And it is really important to see he did both of these things, but look at the order that he did them in. Now, the marketplace there is significant because it was a center of cultural life. We don't have a lot of these places in the United States, but if you guys have ever been to Seattle, okay, Pike's Place Market, whatever there is, right? Okay, that's a market, okay? It's the center of life. This is where, at the time, everybody had to go. Rich, poor, didn't matter who you were, you had to go to the market. It's where the life of the town, where the common people gathered, it was the center of their culture. Now, we don't actually have markets, right, but we have lots of public squares. Public squares, okay? Gyms, parks, malls, okay? There's lots of places where there are public squares, restaurants, pubs, where you have a good opportunity to connect with people. And see what Paul did. He engaged people in the public square through the normal activity that they did. So what was normal for them to do in Athens? It says, talking and exchanging ideas. That was what was normal. And he did this because the culture of a place is always the incarnation of the people of the place. People can discover what the culture is like, and you discover what the people are like. If you can read the style of the culture, then you'll be able to determine the ultimate concerns. The ultimate concerns, not the felt needs, okay, but the real needs. And I have to imagine that in his talking with people in the synagogue and in the marketplace, he confirmed some of what he had seen and felt. And he probably learned a little bit more about those discussions. So, ask yourself, where are the synagogues? And where are the public squares for the marketplaces? What do you believe the ultimate concerns of your particularly mission sphere are, people that are there? Now, the next thing Paul does is as he's in these places of openness, like he's looking for places of openness in the synagogue, in the marketplace, okay, he is looking to establish some commonality. This is where we go back to the story, right? Greece was a place of many gods, but you couldn't just one day say, hey, let's have a new god, right? There was actually a process by which they had to justify the existence of another god, and each god had to be approved by the Athenian council. Now, it is very hard to get to the Athenian council. You had to have a well-thought-out, reasonable, credible presentation for a new god that could be in Athens. You had to be a credible presenter of this. So Paul meets these qualifications, right? I look at the Athenian Council and I can say this is basically of Harvard and Capitol Hill, like all put together. Okay? And in this, okay, Paul's looking to establish commonality. He's striving to be relatable. Okay? I like relatable better than the word relevant because for some reason, I don't know why, but people don't like talking about being relevant anymore because they just think it means cool. Okay? Well, relevant doesn't mean cool. It means whatever you're doing relates. That's all it means. Something that you're sharing relates, therefore people should consider it. It could be easy or hard for them to deal with, but it's still relevant. So he establishes some commonality. Look at what he does. Verse 22, he says, the meeting in the Areopagus, men of Athens, he compliments them. I see that you are very religious. For as I walked around and a careful look at your object of worship, I found an altar with an inscription to an unknown god. Now, what you worship is something unknown. I want to tell you what that is. I'll tell you the story of that. Now, your first thought as a missionary should be when you're in places of openness, synagogues, marketplaces, where is there commonality between the effort that God has given us and our missionary sphere? If you're reaching out to someone, the question should be, where do you have personal commonality? Where do you relate? Where could you do things together? Where could you see them participating in your life and your life and theirs? If a new person comes to your community, your first thought about them as a missionary should be, who do they have commonality with in our community? One of the best practices I've ever seen for helping new people get connected to a missionary endeavor, again, whether they follow Jesus or they don't, is doing multi-person dinners. Okay, it is super normal for a pastor or whatever church plant, somebody comes new to something that they're doing and they want to get together with them, right? Well, some of the best stuff that I've ever seen is people say, hey, don't just get together with me. Let's get three or four other couples or people to meet together who you think have commonality with this person because they're evaluating whether or not they think they fit. If you're trying to embed yourself in a neighborhood, the question is, where do we have commonality? Sometimes you'll do things and you won't even know it. For instance, the story I told there of City Church, the church in our network in D.C. area. They, again, through this kids' festival, lots of people came. Okay, but what they didn't know was that the local city leaders were watching what they were doing. And they came back and said, it's the only group we've ever seen be able to pull together the African-American and the Anglo community. We need to do more with them. They were about ready to run out of their space, okay, paying like $500 a week at this little school they were renting. They didn't know what they were going to do. The city leaders then said, hey, we have a community center. Why don't you meet here for free? Okay, they stumbled on some commonality. Some things you'll do and you will know it. Okay, you talk to J.R. Briggs, he'll give you a ton of examples of ways that they have established commonality in the Lansdale area. Okay? Lots of examples of this. So where do you establish commonality with the needs of your neighborhood? And then, as you start to introduce Jesus into the context of these relationships, you should be looking for the areas of commonality between our faith in Christ and whatever their faith is. Okay, look at what Paul does. As he relates the true story of Christ with the incomplete story. Remember, they don't know the answer to this question. He makes a clear connection between their world, which he learned through his seeing and walking and talking, and the world that the gospel was about to enter. So he takes this question that they had likely been curious about for some time. Who's this unknown God? And he says, I'll tell you. But in telling you, he's telling them, look, God has been at work among you already. Now, I don't know about you guys, and I don't know that everyone would believe in this, but I believe in the doctrine of prevenient grace. And basically, what that tells me on this little diagram is that the God who sent you already sent himself. And he has already gone ahead of you to your missionary sphere. He's already working ahead of you in places of openness, in your synagogues, in your marketplaces. He's already doing these things, giving people enough grace so that they can possibly be saved, right? Maybe the difference between this and common grace is common grace gives them enough grace that they can be damned. Prevenient grace gives them a grace for salvation. That's just my take on it. So the question is, how does the church make a clear connection between the story of people's lives and the story of the gospel? Now, this is where Paul goes and he quotes their own poets and all that sort of thing. But he doesn't shy away from the disagreeing aspects of the way that he sees the world through the way that they see the world, right? He doesn't do that at all. He's just trying to show how the good news of Jesus is the fulfillment of what they are looking for. And then he gets to this. And I think this is Paul's, you know, it's his target missionary approach, which Jesus taught the disciples to do, and I think this is where Paul get it. In places of openness, Paul's looking for people of peace. Looking for people of peace. In Luke chapter 10, Luke chapter 10, it says this, after the Lord appointed 70 others, he sent them in pairs ahead of him to every city and place where he himself was going to come. And he was saying, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. He says, go, behold, I send you out as lambs in the midst of wolves, carry no money. Verse 5, but whatever house you enter, first say, peace be to this house. If a person of peace is there, your peace will rest on him, but if not, it will return to you. If a person of peace is there, stay in that house, eating and drinking what they give you for the laborer of worthy of his wages. Don't keep moving from house to house. Whatever city you enter and they receive you, eat what is set before you and heal those who are in it. And you say to them, the kingdom of God has come near to you. He even tells them what to say. And then skip down at verse 16. He says, the one who listens to you listens to me. The one who rejects you rejects me. And he who rejects me rejects the one who sent me. So what do you say there? Basically, look, the person who receives you, okay, they're going to receive me. So how does Paul, when he goes into an area, this is exactly what he does. Acts chapter 16, Lydia and Philippi, that's his person of peace. He says, I want you to stay with that person. I want you to work through that person to reach the community that you're in. So what's a person of peace? It's like a gatekeeper. Yep, person of peace is a gatekeeper. It's a person who's open to you. So it could be, this is a definition, right? Someone who welcomes you, who is open to you, who God will then use to reach other people who are not open or accessible to you. And how do you know? Very simple. They're open to you. They receive you. They want to serve you. They like you. I could think of a guy that, he's not necessarily the person that I would choose, but he's a guy who's very open to me. He calls me when I haven't called him for a long time. Right? He stays in touch with me, you know, and I'm the person who's reaching out to him. I don't stay in touch with him. He's a person of peace in my life. It doesn't fit with our church strategy, right? So, well, he lives outside the bounds of our missionary sphere, but he's the person that God has put in my life as a person of peace. I don't know where it will lead, but he's definitely a person that's open. Let me give you another example of this. One of the best I've heard from a guy named, like I said at the beginning, Mike Green. He was over in England, and they had some people who were doing a youth work in the city. And one of his youth workers came to him one day and said, Mike, I got a problem. I'm never going to get these six guys that I'm meeting with to come to church. They just don't want to come. There's just nothing about it that wants they want to come to church. So Mike said to them, this guy, Steve, and Steve was, he was just a really, he was a cool guy. And he said, look, I don't want you to bring them to church. I just want you to disciple them. Don't bring them to church. Just disciple them. And eventually they will bring you. So the guy said, Steve, Mike, I can't disciple them. They don't follow Jesus. Like they don't care about any of the discipleship stuff. And he said to him, he said, Steve, well, do they like you? Yeah, they like me. I can't get rid of them. They call me all the time. They want to know what I'm doing when I get off work. They want to know where I've been over the weekend and I haven't seen them. He says, good, why do you suppose they like you? Does everybody like you? No, not everybody likes me. He says, what do you think? What do you think about it like this? What they like about you, they like about Jesus. They just don't know it yet. In other words, they like the Jesus they encounter in you. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to assume that because they like you, they know that you are about Jesus. I just want you to disciple them. So the next time they're all sitting around, hanging around, it's raining, so they can't really go outside and do the normal sort of youth activities they would do. And one of the guys in the group, and this is it's a tough group, says to Steve, he says, Steve, so what's sex like with your girlfriend? And Steve says, well, we don't have sex. And of course, they were like, what? I can't believe that. Like, what's that all about? And he remembered, discipled them. He said, well, I'm a Christian. You guys know that. And I'm involved in the church. And sex to me is, it's like God's wedding present. It's like God's wedding present when you get married. And of course, they have just never heard anything like this. And he can tell that they're troubled by it. And he all he can think of is to say, this is hard for you guys to, right? Yeah, I don't know if I could ever do that. So the only thing he can think about is say, well, do you want to pray about it? And he was a guy who always wore his hat. He was a proper guy. And so it was just normal for him to take off his hat when he was about ready to pray. So in the time he is to take off his hat, one of the other guys in the group starts praying. He says, God, I know you're up there. And, we like Steve here. And he says that we shouldn't have sex till we get married. I don't think I can do that. So you're just going to have to help me. And every person in the circle prays before it gets to Steve. Now, this is one of those great stories, right, where like everyone comes to Christ and they're all in ministry and all that sort of stuff. They're not all like that, but it hopefully illustrates, right? They were open to him, right? They liked him, and so they were therefore open to Jesus and what Jesus was doing. So, who likes you? Who's your person of peace? Person of peace, someone who God will advance his mission through because they are open to you. Therefore, God may be at work in their life, so they are also open to Christ. Jesus tells the disciples, don't focus on the people that are not open to you. Now, with the person of peace, the second thing that is related to this is you're looking at, and this is kind of relates to the gatekeeper idea, is the oikos, the household, the network that the person of peace has. Okay, it's a very related concept, but it is slightly different, so I just want to point it out as different. It's you reach the oikos through a person of peace. And I want to give you a couple examples of this. Church that I'm connected with up in Long Island, it's actually a CMA church. They planted 7 or 8 years ago, just slow, steady growth. Seen some people come to Christ, but just slow, steady. They got to about 150, 200 people, and a guy that had just been coming to their church lost his life at an accident at sea. And so they had the funeral, and the father of this family, is an Italian family in Long Island, right, very connected, came, never been outside of the Catholic Church, came to this funeral of his son's, and heard a clarity of the gospel that he had not heard before. And in time, he came to trust Christ. Well, when he came as the person of peace into his oikos, my friend up there told me it was just another few months and 15 more members of their family came to trust Jesus. Now, word about this kind of got out around. Again, it's a tightly knit community. And again, not everything about numbers, but I'm just going to illustrate this. That church has gone from 200 people to 750 people in about 3 years. And they trace it all back to this funeral, to this one guy coming to Christ, who opened up a whole doorway and network that they had not been able to reach into. It's a person of peace. Into an oikos. Another one, it's a story from the UK. This was a church that was had a missional community reach out to the Iranian community in their area. And they went and they just did some door knocking. That's how they were going to discover people of peace. So they went, had a heart for the Iranian refugees that were there. They started to do some door knocking. And just asking the people that they came across, you know, hey, we're from church up the street. We believe God wants us to be meeting the needs of our neighborhood. Is there anything that we could help you with? Okay? This is a very similar thing to Jesus saying, look, the kingdom of God has come near you. So, this one guy came to the door, and he said, yeah, actually, there's a couple things you could help me with. And later they asked him, you know, he came to faith, and they asked him, what made the difference? He said, you were the first people who came and were friendly to my family. We've lived here for a year. So, just by door knocking. Okay? Now, that guy was an evangelist. He led 50 other Iranians to faith in Christ. Now they have a whole Iranian missional community church that reaches out to the Iranian community. One person. So Jesus says, find your person of peace. Stick with them. Stay with them. Now, all of this results in the end in what I consider to be some practical strategies. So you can kind of develop your practical strategy now based on what you think you know, but it's going to get changed and refined as you start doing all this stuff, right? This session is about sort of missionary approach and missiology. J.R. Briggs on J.R. Woodward on Thursday is going to talk about developing models and approaches to church. Okay, that's your ecclesiology. And on Wednesday morning, J.R. Briggs is going to do a session about reading your city, which is basically sort of like the bridge between these two things. But missionary engagement is carried out through practical missionary strategies. And there are a couple, right? And that's why I like this word missionary instead of missional, because I think it changes the game a little bit, because there are attractional strategies. They're not bad to use, right? There's a difference between an attractional church and an attractional strategy. My friend who planted the church in D.C., Kids Festival, right? That's an attractional strategy. Nothing wrong with it. Okay? There's engaging strategies, right? You go to people who don't know the Lord and you get them to come back with you. Okay? You're sent to return. Then there's incarnational strategies. You go to people who don't know the Lord and you stay there. You're sent to stay. All of these strategies are capable of finding places of openness and people of peace. Every one of them. There are some people who really, you know, rag on mailers and things like that. And, you know, look, you can say whatever you want to say about them. But anybody who's ever done one, okay? Now, we didn't do one here when we came to Richmond. But anyone who's ever done one, if I asked them, did some people come to your community who either didn't know Jesus or ended up really being an integral part of what other people did? Nobody has ever told me that that didn't happen. Nobody's ever told me that didn't happen. At least one person who ended up being an integral part of their community. So, and people say, well, it cost $5,000. I say, well, was that one person worth $5,000? Yes. I'm not advocating that's what you should do. I'm just saying, I've not met anybody who actually said it never yielded anything. It should not be your only strategy. You shouldn't spend $200,000 on it. But it might be something to consider. How did Paul find his people of peace? He went and he was preaching, right? So often he was preaching. Jesus healed people. Okay, what could be more attracting than healing somebody? Okay, Renew does Easter at the Park. This our church down the street here I was talking about, 80% of their community a year ago, a year and a half ago, didn't know Christ. Many of them still don't. They do movie nights in the neighborhood. I mean, they're still attractional strategies. Okay, engaging strategies. Again, another church in our network, they give out water bottles. They're in an urban area. Now, you might think that this just sounds like a thing that you should just never do. Stand out water bottles with the name of your church on it and give them out. The difference, he said, was this. Look, we live in a poor neighborhood. And actually, people aren't as skeptical about this as they are in well-to-do neighborhoods. He said, we have tons of African-American and Latino people in our neighborhood who just like, oh, wow, like this is so nice. And he said, it changed the dynamic of the church, our representation of the church in our neighborhood, just by standing in our water bottles. So, I want to give you guys, all right, now here, this, I try to give you guys a B, if you could answer this question, right? All the way from a D to a B. But I want to give you an example of a missionary strategy. And you tell me if you can fill it in for me, all right? And you can get some help from your fellow people here. All right, now, I'm going to give you a first hint and see if you can fill in the rest of this, okay? Does anybody know what comes next? Crowd. Very good. Very good. And what comes after that? Congregation. That's right. And then you have the committed and the core, right? Now, this is Rick Warren's missionary strategy, okay? Now, just hear me out on this, okay? Hear me out on this. It's not bad as a missionary strategy, with one exception. Rick Warren made every one of these things about church. Every one of these things are about church. But when I go talk to my friend down the street who's planting the most incarnational church I've ever met, full of non-Christian people, and I said, tell me about what you did. Oh, yeah, well, you know, we throw a lot of parties in the neighborhood just to gather people. Just any people we can gather, we just gather people. Check. What are you looking for once that happens? Well, I look for the people who, you know, kind of like coming around more regularly. So we've been throwing parties and doing things over the course of about a year. So I identified about 25 people who regularly came. Check. What'd you do then? Well, I figure these people were kind of open to us. They might have been people of peace or in our oikos. So we started to do some semi-spiritual things. So we started to have conversations and questions about faith. So we did too, and I invited those people to it, and you know, they dig it. It doesn't look like normal church, but we get together and we talk about Jesus, and we can't really do worship and all that stuff or sing because they're just weirded out by that, but they will talk about Jesus, and they love to see what we're doing in the neighborhood and building community. I said, okay, well, what did you do after that? Well, there were some of those people who were really open, and we started to get them into a discipleship group, and I meet with them every week. And I am just walking them through what God is doing in their life, what God's saying about it to them. I'm trying to help them in the foundations of the faith. Okay, good. And then what's at the center of all this? Oh, we have a core of 6 to 10 people who are our core team. Now, his church doesn't look a bit like Rick Warren's church. But it's not a bad missionary strategy as long as you don't saddle it, no pun intended, with church. You don't saddle it with your expectations and conceptions of church. Okay? You can develop your own. But here's another one, right? This is a basic missionary strategy that has been used for years and years and years in other parts of the world. And it is almost the same thing. It's an inverted funnel. And it's called the S1, S2, S3, reaping and keeping. So they say, look, when you go into an area and you're trying to establish a missionary base, you do S1 things. Okay, this stands for sowing, level one. They don't obviously use this language with people, but this is just, you're just doing stuff to create community. There's nothing spiritual about this at all. Parties, events, you're just doing stuff to create a sphere so that people are in your sphere. He says, and then what you do is you invite people down to the next phase. It can be really easy, but he says, for instance, you can do this personally. Someone's up here and say, you know, my life has really been changed. Sometime I'd like to tell you the story about that. If they say yes, well, they can move here. Problem is, lots of churches in their strategies, in terms of engaging with people, they make people move here. They don't invite them to move here, right? So you always want to invite people, okay? So this is lots of relationship, no gospel. Lots of relationship, but a little gospel. And then sowing three. This could be a variety of things, but if you're presenting a high amount of gospel content to people. Again, but they have invited themselves into this category. Reaping, them coming to faith, keeping is discipleship. Again, it's just another basic missionary strategy. Okay, there are some, which you'll see from later in this week, from based off of an expansion of Robert Weber's work that a guy, J.R. Woodward, in our network uses, which basically runs the gamut from a person who's a skeptic all the way down to a kneeler, a servant in the church, right? And I think there's like 7 or 8 categories in terms of where people's life is in the life of Jesus. And you need to think about each of these categories of people because their needs are different. He'll show that to you later. So you've got to have some practical missionary strategies. Okay. I'm done. Questions? Yeah. Robert Weber, Journey to Jesus is the book. And if you look, and I don't want to steal all his stuff, but you can look and he'll explain it to you later. On the Developing Models and Approaches section, later in the week, which is in section 4, at least I think it's in here, and if it's not, it'll be in here later. Well, okay, he didn't put it in there, so look, he's saving it to share it with you just himself. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, obviously, those folks that you're talking about, I mean, they could be sent from another church to join you in your missionary efforts. That'd be one way to look at it. If you were just without knowing your area, you're in Easton, which is up near Allentown, right? Right. Probably a lot of opted out Catholics, right? Okay. I've known of some people who have done some creative things around the sacraments, because that's highly valued in the Catholic Church, but in abnormal ways. So I'm trying to think of one example. But for instance, going to a local community organization around Lent and saying, hey, why don't we give up some time, right, during Lent, and go repaint some schools, right? Predominantly Catholic area, people get Lent. So some people wanted to do that, right? Okay, I can do that for 40 days, right? So that would be maybe an example of a possible synagogue kind of place. I'd have to know more about your area, but that would be one. We could talk more about it. Yeah. 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 And that's a hard question to answer, right? It would take a while to talk about some of those specific things. But I answer that with a story. Well, not really a story, but just to say that the greatest conversions that have been taking place in the Islamic world are through something called Messianic mosques. Just like we have Messianic synagogues. Now, most people don't have a problem with Messianic synagogue. But you hear Messianic mosque and you think something different. But the greatest amount of salvations have come through Messianic mosque. So, again, that's not really an answer, but yeah. Yeah, well, disenfranchised people, you know, they're really two kinds, right? There's people that are open to returning and people that are not. And actually, the people who were part of a church or had faith and have left it somehow and are not open are the hardest group of people to reach, the hardest. So you got to determine among, you know, are there, again, a peace person's a peace. You know, are they open? They have some level of openness. And, you know, it may take time, but the question, are they open to you? They're open to you. So, obviously, yeah, eventually, you know, I think you always want to, okay, I'll just tell a story. It's a missionary story, right? So, many years ago, this is in the New Zealand area, there was a group of people who wanted to, plant churches in a variety of islands. And many people had failed at this. So what they did, this new strategy, they sent a team, and they went to each island, and they went to the leading tribe, and they asked to speak to the lead elder. In each of these islands, there's like 20 islands. And they, one of the elders on one island was open. The person of peace. So they had 12 people on the team. They sent 6 of them there. And they said, we're just going to stay here on this one island with this one tribe. And we're going to live among this. We're going to set up our sphere. The other 6 members of the team would rotate week by week to all the other islands praying. That's what they did. The one elder on the island eventually came to faith. His tribe came to faith. The whole island began to come to faith. And when the other island heard what was happening there, they wanted to know what was going on. The other people continued to pray. So it's just an example like, okay, fertile soil, infertile soil. So what do you do for infertile soil? You pray, right? And in some way they had presence. But here, you know, they worked, they focused on the fertile area. So you pray in infertile soil, and you focus on the fertile soil. Yes. Are you in a neighborhood? Yeah. Yeah. Well, then I would focus on your neighborhood. If you, you know, to the extent that people have, to the people in your church plant team, do they live in that neighborhood in general? Yeah, I would focus on that. So our focus in the neighborhood, we're looking for people of peace in the neighborhood. Now, if somebody's having a person of peace at work, it's, I mean, you know, hey, that's great. But look for the people in the neighborhood that are open first. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. Yeah. 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 That's great. Well, you just got to start somewhere. So it's not good to, you know, it's going to be harder to say we're going to reach all 24,000 people, the whole city, versus saying, we're going to start here, and then as God blesses our efforts or fruitfulness, then we can expand out, right? Yes, right. Put your focus. Where's the places of openness? You know, right. you know, just in general, the most, I mean, okay, there's lots of receptive people, but the most receptive groups of people, okay, if you ever say, what do you do when nobody's receptive? Well, there are almost two groups of people that are always receptive. Children and elderly people. Almost always receptive. So if there's no receptivity, you can almost guarantee there's receptivity there. So then you start there. And who's receptive? Parents of people, parents of children who have been open, right? So that's where I would start. Yeah. And I would encourage, just I would encourage all of your people, you teach people of peace. There's not a single person who's in our leadership community who doesn't know people of peace. I think most of them could tell you who their people of peace are. And they could, some of them, an increasing number, could tell you what they are doing to cooperate with God's activity to see their people of peace come to faith. It's just so simple. You know, it's like, hey, don't try to people that are not open. Just focus on where God's already looking. Yeah, basically. Yep. Right. Yep. Yep. Yeah, like just to give you an example. So this is our plan for the next 6 months. We've got several S1 things happening in our church, right? Just totally easy open parties. We're doing this free cycle thing to share stuff and all that kind of stuff. Then we have something that we do in our church called Storytellers, which is basically a meal with a testimony. It's like lots of relationship. It's good food and very little. It's a little gospel, right? And then what we plan on doing is, because people are still very open, right? I mean, the evangelical church has largely left the church calendar, and that's been negative on a missionary sense, because the times of year, the time of year that people are most open is Christmas. I mean, like, it's like two times the level of openness as Easter when you survey people. When are they most open to spiritual things? Christmas. So our plan for our S3 thing is to have a strong focus at Christmas season. And just, you know, hey, say, this, I mean, if there's a time of year to invite people to church, that's the time of year to do it. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that later. Yeah. I would just say, like, okay, with the circles of Rick Warren's example, okay, that's an attractional church, because they're relying on attractional strategies to do everything that needed to happen. It's always about getting people to come to the church, right? Right. Yeah. So, okay, guys, it's 10 o'clock.